So we've been going through the life of Jesus already for a couple months. It's been fun. We're just kind of getting to the good stuff. I mean, it's all been good, don't get me wrong, but we're kind of getting to that spot where it's like it's more detailed, there's more stuff going on. And we're going through, last week we saw Jesus go back home. It was not a very happy homecoming, not exactly what you would hope for. If you missed that or if you missed anything, I'd encourage you to go on our website or go on YouTube or backlog Facebook. You can see the videos there and kind of get caught up. But we're going to see something different today. Jesus, in the stories that we're going to tell today, is going to do something new. He's going to step forward in a new way, in a new public way, in two different, very different stories, two different, very, very different ways, and two different scenarios. And we're going to see that. So as we study through, we've talked about before that there are four accounts of Jesus' life that we find in our Bibles, in the Christian scriptures, the New Testament. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the four Gospels, we call them, are accounts of Jesus' life. They're at the very beginning of our New Testament. And they each tell a different story. They tell the same story in a different way, from their own perspective, for their own purposes, and the different details that they tell. And we've seen that. Today, we're just going to look in the book of John. So if you want to follow along in your Bibles, you can go to the Gospel of John. We'll be in chapter 2. If you want to use an app, I'd encourage you to do that. It's an awesome way to always have the scriptures with you. If you want to just sit back and follow along, it'll be on the screen. For those of you online, it'll be on your screen as well. And we'd encourage you to do that. So we're going to be in the book of John, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and John chapter 2. John begins the story this way. He says, "The next day, there was a wedding celebration in the village of Cana in Galilee." So just to remind you a couple things, A, this is coming after John chapter 1, so he's like, everything I just told you at the end of chapter 1, now the next day. But also in Galilee. So Jesus, the area that he ministered in, the two main areas were Galilee, that was farther up north, and then Judea farther south. So Galilee is up north, where Nazareth was his hometown, and some other towns, and he'll spend some time up there. Judea is farther south. That's where Jerusalem is. That's where Bethlehem was, where he was born. So there's those kind of things. So he's been teaching and doing different stuff in Galilee, and that's where he's at. There's a wedding celebration. John continues and says, Jesus' mother was there. So Mary is there, and Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the celebration. And you're like, hold on a second. Disciples, that's a new one for me in our story. We haven't seen that yet, and that's a good catch if you saw that. So next week, Arlen's going to be back, and he's going to kind of go through, because there's a lot of different details. There's a lot of different groups of disciples, calling of different disciples, and we'll see that next week. But for today, just to kind of understand what we're talking about, any kind of public speaker at that time would have people who would gather to listen. Some people who would gather to listen and like, yeah, I'm down with that. I follow that. And then there are people that were literally followers. They would go around with him. You can think of it like a student-teacher or mentor-mentee relationship. They would literally travel and be part of a group of people learning from this rabbi or teacher that Jesus was. So Mary's there. Jesus is there. He's got a group of people with him. They're all at this wedding celebration. Verse 3, the wine supply ran out during the festivities. So Jesus' mother told him, they have no more wine. Now, if you were an English major or you study English, there are different types of sentences that have different purposes. And this, if you just read it, sounds like information. Just Jesus' mother comes up and says, hey, they've got no more wine. Okay, move along. But if you've ever had a mother, you know that there are such things that are informational sentences that are not meant to be informational. They are meant to tell you something more than just the facts. Here's a quick example. If you're, as a child, your mother ever came up to you, hopefully it doesn't happen as an adult now. If that's true, your relationship, we'll figure that out later. As a child, if your mother ever came up to you and said, your room is unclean, she was not telling you to let you know that your room is not clean. A, you knew. B, that's not the purpose. So then the response should not be, yes, I know. That's not going to go well. Also, your response should not be, thank you for telling me. I appreciate that. Thank you for making me informed. Because she didn't tell you that for that reason. She said, your room's not clean. Do something about it. I didn't tell you to let you know. I told you to let you know. I expect you to do something. And this is kind of what Mary's doing here. in a nice way, but she's like, hey, they have no more wine. Wink, wink, nod, nod. So do something about it. And Jesus has to figure out now. So verse 4, Jesus says to Mary, dear woman, that's not our problem. My time has not yet come. And here's one of the things I have to tell you. I am so thankful for modern Bible translations. I was raised with a King James Version that was translated back in 1611 originally and updated a couple times. Their translation of this verse is completely different. It basically says in that version, woman, not a good start to the conversation. Woman, what do I have to do with you? And look, I was raised on this. We were taught to memorize. But if my mom ever came up to me and told me something, and my first answer was, woman, my dad would not be like, he would not be pleased with me saying, but I'm quoting Jesus. He's like, I don't care who you're quoting. You're in trouble. So I'm glad that we have a more appropriate, that we understand what he was trying to say. So Jesus is just saying this, mom, dear woman, that's not our problem. You see, I'm just here for the party. I'm an invited guest. I didn't order the catering, mom. I didn't plan the guest list. I'm on the invite list, not on the organized list. That's not our problem. And I'm not sure it's time for me to do anything about that right now. And you're like, that makes sense. But here now, Mary has a decision to make. Because what is she going to respond? Because mom's asked something, and son has responded with, no. Now, she could do the mother thing. Some mothers, she'd say, you may be God, but I'm your mother. She could do that and decide how wise that would be. She could do that. She could do the guilt trip mom thing. Well, I just thought it'd be nice, you know, it's a party and they really need some help and maybe you could just do something this time, but I understand if you don't want to, you don't want to make me happy. She could do that. And you're like, how is she going to respond? And Mary does a beautiful response that we're going to see. In this mix, she mixes her faith with submission. Verse 5, his mother told the servants, do whatever he tells you. There's servants around, their job is to do it. She just says, okay, I've made my request. I'm just going to look at the servants and say, do whatever he tells you. He may tell you to get back to work. He may tell you to just go serve and do the best you can with what you have. He may say to do something about it. Whatever he tells you, I want you to do it. And it's this beautiful mix, and this is not the point, but I can't go past it today, of Mary is looking at it. Mary has just prayed. Okay, I know sometimes we think of prayer as being this weird, crazy thing, but literally prayer is just talking to God, bringing our requests, and Mary's just prayed. Mary has come to God, Jesus, and said, I have a request. And now she has to wait. And she mixes her faith with the submission and says, I came to you believing that you can. Now I'm just waiting and asking that you will. And if you ever find yourself in a spot and you're like, I don't know how to pray for this one, can I suggest something based on Mary? Just go to God and say, God, I believe that you can do something about this problem, about this situation. That's why I'm coming to you in the first place, because I believe that you can do something about it. And I'm just asking that you will. And I'm going to wait and see what you do. And whatever you decide, I'll be okay with. Whatever you tell me based on that, I'm okay with. What a level of faith that Mary has. Well, John continues the story because now Jesus is sitting there and says, okay, this has all happened, and now Jesus has this person of faith and his mom standing right there, and he's deciding what to do. So John continues, verse 6, he says that standing nearby were 6 stone water jars used for Jewish ceremonial washing, and each could hold 20 to 30 gallons. For comparison, if you go to a water cooler, see the blue jug on the top, that holds about 5 gallons. So each of these is 4 to 6 times that size, and there's 6 of them. So it's anywhere from about 120 to 180 gallons that these things can hold. For example, if you've been here and we've had the hot tub set up for baptism, that we usually put 150 to 175 gallons, okay? And I will tell you, as somebody who's helped fill those up, it takes a while to fill those up, no matter how you do it. Now these guys, they've got to figure out something, because Jesus says, verse 7, Jesus told the servants, fill the jars with water. And this was not, okay, Bob, bring the hose. Okay, this is not what could be done. Or let's wheel it to the sink and kind of just start filling it up. They would have to go to the well. And they'd have to draw the water and bring it back and pour it in and do it multiple times. That takes a lot of time. Those are big jars to fill. And I wonder if the servants are sitting there saying, do we tell them? We didn't have a water problem. If we needed water, I would have gone and got water. That's my job. I know he heard her say that. She said, we're out of wine, not we're out of water. But the servants just listened to Mary. They just did what he told them to do. And I don't know how long it took, but it took a while, but eventually they got it done. John continues the story. He says, when the jars had been filled, he said, now dip some out and take it to the master of ceremonies. So the servants followed his instructions. If you know the story, don't spoil it, but you know something's coming. Now, I don't know if the something that's coming happened when they finished filling the jars. I don't know if it happened when they dipped it out. I don't know if it happened on their journey over to the master of ceremonies or if it happened when they handed it to him. I don't know, and John doesn't tell us because John didn't think it was important. And I think John, as we'll see in a little bit, John's got a little way of writing that's kind of fun. I think he's like, I'll leave it up to you. You imagine it. It's more fun that way. So at some point, something happens along this path. And John kind of tells it almost as an aside. Verse 9, when the master of ceremonies tasted the water that was now wine, not knowing where it had come from, though of course the servants knew, like, of course they knew, John, but he just throws that in because John's having fun as he's writing his story. He called the bridegroom over. So here's what happens to the servants. They dip some out, like Jesus said. They took it to the guy that's in charge of the party, the master of ceremonies, and they hand it to him. And at some point, they figured out what's going on, and they watch him drink it. And then he calls the groom to come. And I don't know about you, but if I was one of those servants, I have to imagine what they probably did is they kind of found a way to stay around. You know, maybe they started polishing something that was already clean. Like, I just want to see what he says. Or they kind of hid in the background and turned their back and kind of made it look like they were busy because they want to hear. Because now something amazing has happened. They're the only ones that know. In this, the master of ceremonies doesn't know where it came from. He's just like, hey, thanks for bringing more. And they wonder what's going to happen. Well, the master of ceremonies, verse 10, says to the groom, he says, a host always brings the best wine first. Then, when everyone has had a lot to drink, he brings out the less expensive wine. But you have kept the best until now. He's like, I know how this goes. I'm the host. I'm the master of ceremonies. You know, those people always kind of feel like they're important. I've done this a lot of times, and I know how this goes. When it's at the beginning, you put out the really good appetizers first and the really good things. And then as the party goes on, you either say, you know what, they can't taste it as well anymore, so bring out the cheap stuff. Or it's everybody's treating it like a party and it's an open bar and they just keep going back and we need this getting expensive. So you just kind of put the nice stuff away and you just bring out what you have left. It's like if you ever go to a restaurant and they keep offering you more bread and a refill on your drink. Do you ever wonder, you ever get to the spot where it's like, is the food going to be bad? Like, you keep trying to give me this stuff. Is the food, A, coming? B, is it going to be horrible where you just hope I'm too full to care? And he's like, this is the way it usually goes, but you've not done that. You've waited and given the best till now. And this is our story. And John summarizes it this way. He says, this miraculous sign at Cana in Galilee was the first time Jesus revealed his glory. And his disciples believed in him. This is a theme we're going to see throughout John. We'll see it again today and as we go through our story. So watch for this. Anytime we're in John, look for these things. John loves this word, believe, believe, believe. So the servants knew, the disciples knew, Mary knew, Jesus knew. And that was it. And John's like, this is the first time. It was something special. It was something new that happened that Jesus said, yeah, I can do that. I can step in for when there's a need. And then John continues, he says, after the wedding, he went to Capernaum for a few days with his mother, his brothers, and his disciples. I'm going to take a break here to remind us that the Gospels are written to tell a story, not to provide a timeline. Because the way we would write it these days, at least the way I would think to write it, would be like, okay, February 1st, he did this and this. 6 days later on the 7th, this is what happened. That's not what they're doing. They're getting you to a story. Okay, that's why they're writing what they're writing. Now, I say that for two reasons. One, if you're looking and saying, I've read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and I'm trying to fit the timeline, and it's hard to figure out that this is the first miracle, how do you make that fit? And there's ways to look at it, and just to remember that that's what the Gospels are there for. That's not what they're trying to accomplish. They just want to tell you about Jesus. The other reason I tell you is because the story that we're about to see is mentioned in all four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. But John tells it at the very beginning. We're only in chapter 2. And he tells the story that we're about to see. Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't touch it. They don't reference it. They don't say anything until almost the very end as they tell the story. And that's led a lot of people to look at it and say, okay, there's two options. One is, this isn't a one-time event that happened one time. And John, for whatever his reason, the way he's writing his story, chose to tell it early and never again. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke said, you know what? We're just going to save it. We're going to tell it at the end. And a lot of people who love God, love the Bible, love Jesus, all those check boxes, that's what they believe. There are other people who look at it and say, this probably happened twice. And John tells the time that it happened early on and doesn't care about the second one. He's like, I already told that. It happened twice. I'll tell you one time. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't tell us this first time and tell us the second. And you say, which one is right? I don't know. I wasn't there. There are people, again, like I said, who love God, love the Bible, love Jesus, and do all that stuff, and they subscribe to each way. Here's what I'll tell you in terms of theology, fancy words, or just practical faith. It doesn't matter. Because both of them tell you the story that Jesus was born, Jesus was born, Jesus lived, Jesus died, Jesus rose again, and that's the story they're telling. How they get there is the way they go. So with all that being laid out, let's look at the story that's had way too much buildup and not enough detail. John, the very next verse says, in verse 13, it was nearly time for the Jewish Passover celebration. So Jesus went to Jerusalem. So he's been up in Galilee. He goes now down south to Judea. And this is the Passover. This is one of the big, big religious events for Yahweh followers. You would make a pilgrimage if you could. If you were nearby, you would go. If you were devout, this is something that Jesus has done before. We saw when he was 12 years old, he went with his parents. It was a yearly thing that they did. So this is very normal, along with thousands of people. It was a big gathering for this event. And you'd have so many different aspects of Passover, including going to the temple, all these things. Well, as Jesus is there for the Passover and in the temple, verse 14 says that in the temple area, he saw merchants selling cattle, sheep, and doves for sacrifice. And he also saw dealers at tables exchanging foreign money. Now, to make all of this make sense, we need to dwell on it for a second. So one of the things at this time, they were still doing animal sacrifices at the temple, just the same as so many other religions were doing at the same time, a couple thousand years ago. So, but you would come and you would offer your sacrifice, your animal sacrifice. Now, it would be difficult if you're making a journey to bring an animal with you. It had to meet certain criteria. It couldn't be damaged or bruised or things like that. It had to meet certain criteria. And on top of just travel was difficult. Now adding not just bringing an animal with you, but bringing an animal you had to take care of for a ceremonial purpose would be even more difficult. So people had begun selling these animals where it's like just keep them at home and you can buy them here. And that's very convenient. If you've ever traveled and you're starting to pack and you're like, this is way too much, I'm just going to wait and I'll buy it when we get there. Because either the TSA is taking it or I don't want to pack it. There's not enough room in the car. Whatever it is, you're like, I'll just buy some when we get there. And that's what they would do. And you're like, well, that's convenient. That's very nice of them to do it. And it was. The problem was it was an opportunity for these people that were in charge of the temple to make a little bit of extra money. Because if this is where you could get them, well, you would be paying a premium. Because once you get to where you're going, you're not going to go back home. So we can charge you extra. And even at times, they went so far as to say that those were the only approved animals for sacrifice. So not only can you buy them here, you have to buy them here, all at a markup that would just make the people rich, that were supposed to be the people running the temple to welcome people to come and meet God. Like, okay, I get that. What about the foreign money? Because that makes sense if you're traveling. You know, if I go to England, I've got to switch dollars for pounds, or I go to Europe for euros or wherever. That makes sense that you have to exchange the foreign money. Well, there's another thing. Part of what their law required was the payment of what became known as the temple tax. you'd have to pay money, and it was designed to keep the religious apparatus going. And people all over the world, all Yahweh followers that had been dispersed from Judea and Israel a long time ago, would send money back, and they would pay it. Or when they would come to Jerusalem for Passover or whatever else, they would pay this tax. But it became that you couldn't just pay it in any money. You couldn't just bring your money and give it. You would have to pay it in a certain specific coin. And so you'd have to exchange your money for this special coin to be able to do this. This thing that you had to do, just like the animal sacrifices you had to do. And again, it was an opportunity for, well, the exchange rate may be a little bit high, but where else are you going to get it? And it became this source of resentment, as you can imagine. Like, I'm just trying to go and worship God, and I keep running into these people that are just taking advantage of me. And Jesus knows what that's like. He's not a wealthy person. He came from a poor family. He's experienced all of this, but he's also seeing what it's doing to people who are trying to meet with God and running into people out to make a buck. And here's where I have to prepare you. If your only vision of Jesus is medieval paintings where he kind of looks a little sad, be ready, because the next four words will change a lot. Verse 15, Jesus made a whip. I mean, those words, it's one of those, if you're writing the story, like, I did not expect to have those four words in there. Jesus made a whip. But either way, let's continue. From some ropes, and he chased them all out of the temple. He drove out the sheep and cattle, scattered the money changers' coins over the floor, and turned over their tables. Wait a second, I thought this was nice Jesus, the one that was just happy to be at a party and helping them along. It's like, oh, this same Jesus is a little different, because something different going on. Verse 16, then going over to the people who sold doves, he told them, get these things out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a marketplace. We'll do the same again, Caden, verse 17, and then go back. Then his disciples, after all seeing all of this, verse 17, his disciples remembered this prophecy from the scriptures. Passion for God's house will consume me. And they're like, that's what that verse means. I always thought it was like, oh, I love going to the temple. It makes me feel tingly. It makes me feel special when I go to the temple. And they're like, oh, that's what it means. That's what it means to be passionate and consumed about the temple. And I have to go back to verse 16 because I want to point out something to you that I find interesting. So he drives out the cattle, gets the whip. Okay, if you need a visual on this one, Jesus just went full Indiana Jones on these people, okay? I mean, this is like Jesus. I don't know if he looked like Harrison Ford, but picture it for a second. Jesus just going around with a whip, whoosh, and just knocking everything out. The cattle are going, the sheep are going, he's throwing coins on the table, flipping tables over, and he goes over in all of this commotion to the people who sold doves and says, get them out of here. Why? Why not just throw them over too? Well, you can catch cattle, you can catch sheep, you can pick money off the floor, and you can straighten the table. You know what's really hard to catch? Wild birds. You ever have a bird fly in your house? They don't do predictable things. Try and catch one outside. Try and run up to a bird and catch it. And Jesus is going up and saying, look, the only thing I'm here to cost you, I'm not here to cost you money. I'm here to cost you your pride, and I'm here to cost you your opportunity of mistreating people. That's what I'm upset at. Because you can catch the cattle, you can catch the sheep. Like, what about the coins? They were exchangers. They've got a list. They know exactly what they've given out, what they've taken in. They'll figure it out. They didn't lose anything other than pride and everything going crazy. Okay, because this was the temple. There are thousands of people around. There are groups of people there's a teacher teaching a class, teaching a group of people. And some guy starts going off with a whip and cattle are going everywhere and sheep and people or whatever. You ain't teaching your class anymore because that's distracting. There are people who are at the temple. They were there to pray. You ever try to pray when people are making noise? You ever try to pray when it's quiet? It's sometimes hard enough to focus, but especially when there's a lot going on. There are sacrifices going on, the actual religious thing that's going on, and all of that's getting messed up because it's messing up the line because people were supposed to get in line, get their animal, go, and all of this is getting interrupted. You know who else is there? Roman soldiers. Because this was a busy place. There would always be soldiers, but at the Passover celebration, there's extra security. Like if you watch the Super Bowl tonight in New Orleans, there is a lot of extra security because there's a lot of extra people there. And when riots would break out at the temple, people would die. The soldiers would freak out. to try to keep the peace and make sure nothing would go crazy. So all of this is going on, and Jesus is not just what I always pictured because I was young and in Sunday school and we'd have flannel graph. Anybody old enough for flannel graph? It's a little thing, and you'd have these little thin 2D things put on there, and you tell the story, you tell this part, and then Jesus just, in my mind, just stands there. That's awkward. But it just stands there until the teacher pulls it out and puts the next scene up. But that's not what's happening. There's commotion all over the place. People are trying to catch everything. People are moving stuff. And Jesus is teaching and keeps making the point about this is my Father's house and this is God's house and you shouldn't be doing this. And as you can imagine, not everybody is happy. The people that are in charge of the temple aren't just like, he's a nice boy. I like him. He's got spunk. Yeah, I wouldn't have thought to make a whip. That wouldn't have crossed my mind. No, they're like, you're messing with the program. This is not going well. So they come up to him, verse 18. The Jewish leaders demanded, what are you doing? Okay, you keep saying God and your Father and whatever. I don't care about that. If God gave you authority to do this, show us a miraculous sign to prove it. They're looking at Jesus not respectfully. They're not treating him as an equal. They're saying, look, we're the ones. You see, I got the temple robe. I got the position. I've got the name badge that tells you who I am and what my position is. You got nothing. So boy, if you got something to say, you better prove it. And if that bothers you, I'm not talking about Jesus. That's what they're doing because they're not treating him in that way. They're not being like, oh, what are you doing? Show us. You better have something to prove that you're legit. And Jesus is like, all right, verse 19. Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And before we get to their response, I want you to think about this, the way they thought about it. I want you to look around at this building. What would you say if somebody came up and said, go ahead and tear this church, raise it to the ground. And in 3 days, by myself, I will build it back up just the way it was. You're not like, yes, I could totally see you doing that. Yeah, that seems feasible. Like, you're out of your mind. This was not what they were talking about. The temple was a wonder of the world at the time. It was imposing. It was huge. So they respond as you would expect them to. Verse 20, what? Like, you're crazy. It has taken 46 years to build this temple. And you're going to rebuild it in 3 days. Look, buddy, you may not, maybe you got mental issues. I don't know what your deal is, but it took thousands of people, years, decades, 46 years. There is no chance that you can do it in 3 days. You're crazy. And then John steps back in and says, let me get you some more detail. Verse 21 says, but when Jesus said this temple, he meant his own body. And after he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this. And they believed. Told you it would show up again. And they believed both the scriptures and what Jesus had said. Because this is what Jesus is doing in this moment. He says, guys, what is the temple? What's the whole point of this building? So the point of a temple, the point of this temple, is where people were supposed to come and God would meet with them. If somebody needed to meet with God, they would come here. And God would come here to meet with his people. And the problem is, a long time ago, this temple stopped being that. Because people kept coming to meet God and all they'd run into is you. And you would mistreat them and you would extort them. And that's not what we're doing anymore. Things are changing. And Jesus says, if you want to talk about where the new place is, the new place where God and man come together, Jesus says, it's me. Jesus is where God and man meet because he is God and man together. And he has come to bring God to us and come to call man to God. And Jesus is saying, we're done with this place. And I'll prove it in a few years. But if you don't believe me, that's fine. Do whatever you want to this temple. And let's see how that works out for you. Because 3 days, I'm going to be back better than ever. In a few decades from now, you're going to figure out when they do destroy this temple, it ain't coming back. because this is now where God and man will meet. And those are the stories. And you're like, okay, that story made sense. That story made sense. How do they make sense together? I'm glad you asked. On one hand, it's as simple as this is Jesus for the first time stepping out into a new way. It's the first time he's doing something to say, look, I have power and I'm going to show it off. And I'm going to do it for somebody who just needs it. And let's be honest, it wasn't necessary. If we run out of pop at the Super Bowl party tonight, big game party, sorry, copyright, it's not a big deal. This isn't somebody was sick or dying. And Jesus is like, no, you need help, I'm there. And the first time he showed. And this time, it's the first time he steps in and says, okay, now we need to talk. Because for a long time, for years and years, I've seen this go on, and for centuries it's been going on, and my father and I watched and we weren't happy, and now it's time to start that conversation of saying, hey, we're gonna fix this or there's gonna be a problem. First time Jesus does that. But more than that, this is a microcosm. This is the story of the Gospels. It'll be in different ways. The stories won't be exactly this way, but it'll be stories of Jesus saying, do you need help? How can I help? Oh, you're sick? Your child is dying or has died? You're in need? Come. Come to me. Let me help you. Hey, you guys, you're getting in the way of the people that are trying to come to my father? No, we're not going to do that. We're going to have that talk. We're going to do that. And this is, we will see over the next weeks and months, this is what Jesus does. If I could put it this way, this is Jesus saying, I'm here for them. And you should be too. Do you need me? Do you need help? Come, I'm here for you. I'm here for you. Hey, those of you who claim to represent my father, those of you who claim to represent God or you've been given power or authority by him, whether it's political or religious, whatever it is, you should be there for them because that's what I'm here to do. And that's what you should be doing. This is what Jesus is doing. This is his message. To those in need, he provides. To those who represent God and power poorly, he rebukes. Say, okay, cool. Information, I got it. But with information, there's also something what do we do about it? And for that, we're going to go all the way back to our first story, to what Mary said. What's the difference? It's do this, do what she said. Do whatever he tells you. Are you in need? He says, come. So do what he tells you. Come to Jesus. Do you want help for someone else? Come and ask. So many times people would come on behalf of somebody else, just like Mary did. Hey, somebody's got a problem. Can you do something? It was there. And that faith was rewarded. Not always in the way that they expected, but it was. When he looks at the religious leaders and says, stop turning my father's house into a marketplace. You know what they could have done? What he told them. If they would have stopped, things would have been different. But they didn't. But some people did do what he told them to do. That's the difference between being somebody that's like Jesus and somebody that is opposing Jesus. For myself, when I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom. Do whatever he tells you. I know that's not how the song goes. If you're a fan of that song, either you're welcome or I'm sorry. But hopefully you'll think about it. Because this is Mary's thing. And she's just saying, she's passed it along. And John said, ooh, that's good. I like what she said there. I should tell somebody about it. So do what he tells you. As we continue this series, as we continue to look, and we'll get past just what Jesus did, and into actually things that he taught. What he did teaches, and we can learn from that. But as we get to the rest of it and what he teaches, do it. Look, as you follow along with us in our journey, and hopefully you read the Bible for yourselves at home, and you see what Jesus says to do, do it. And you read the rest of the New Testament, and it's a bunch of people who were Jesus followers saying, this is what Jesus told us, and this is what it looks like to do it in Galatia, and in Rome, and in Ephesus, and in this place, and in your spot, and Philemon when you deal with your runaway slave, and Timothy as you're leading people, and all these things. This is what Jesus said, and this is how you do it. Imagine if that's what we were known for. Imagine if our families did that. What if we treated each other the way that Jesus told us we should? How would our family drama be different? As a church, that's what we try to do. That's why we reach out to our community and we do things. If that's what we were known for, oh, those are the people that do what Jesus says. What would that look like? What would that result in? As hard as it is to imagine, what would happen if our politics looked like that? No, that's not believable, but it kid me. What if that's what we were characterized by? Did we treat people? Did we do the things that Jesus told us to do? What kind of difference would that make? Well, I can tell you, it would change the world. Now, it's not easy. It is cross hard and Roman nails tough to do that because it will cost you. And if it was easy, then Jesus would have to apologize to himself first and to his early followers because it did not end well. But that's the sneaky part of the story. Like, it didn't end well. You stopped at the wrong point. That wasn't the ending. The cross wasn't the ending. Resurrection was. And whatever end his followers met was not their ending. And they would tell you right now it was worth it because of what it did. And it changed the world. And it can change our world, too. So what do we do? I hope this week that you'll ask God the dangerous question. So what do you want me to do? But be prepared for the answer. And be prepared to, like Mary, say, okay, I'll do whatever you tell me. We're going to sing a song in a moment, Make Room. Make room for Jesus. Let him do whatever he wants to. It's rewarding. It's challenging. It'll cost you at times. But it's the best outcome that you can do. And at some point, you ask the millions of people who have done it over the years, they'll tell you. It's worth it.